From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. It's Here and Now. The longtime CFO of the Trump Organization pleaded guilty to 15 felony tax fraud charges in a Manhattan criminal court today. Alan Weisselberg is likely to spend up to 100 days in jail for orchestrating schemes that allowed him and other executives to avoid paying taxes on special perks like luxury cars or apartments. The Trump Organization has also been charged in this case, and Weisselberg, who's been close with the Trump family for years, may be called to testify in a future trial. Let's bring in Ilya Meretz, who covers Trump legal matters for NPR. Hi, Ilya.
Hi, how you doing?
So prosecutors from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office say Weisselberg conspired with the Trump Organization for years to avoid paying taxes. What happened in court today?
Basically, Alan Weisselberg admitted to this scheme, which ran for a decade and a half, to avoid state, federal, and local taxes, basically by paying out benefits to employees, including Alan Weisselberg and also others, through benefits like private school tuition and cars. This was effectively income that was not declared, and it was done, prosecutors say, not only by Alan Weisselberg, but also with the cooperation and support of the Trump Organization. Weisselberg will have to repay $1.9 million just to state and local tax authorities. So today in court, the judge ran Alan Weisselberg through all 15 counts, read them to him. He admitted to each one, and then they sketched out the details of a plea agreement. Basically, in exchange for pleading to all 15 counts, Weisselberg will get 5 months in prison, which will likely be reduced to about 100 days. But he will have to testify about his former employer, the Trump Organization, and its role in the crimes he's already admitted to.
And what could he possibly say about the company? What would you be listening for?
Well, you know, the Manhattan District Attorney went to the Supreme Court twice, had to go to the Supreme Court twice to obtain voluminous Trump financial records. So there's already a very strong paper case that this happened. But what Alan Weisselberg can do for a jury is explain to them exactly how this worked and explain to them the motivation behind it. And so, and you know, they might call up a ledger, say, where Weisselberg's perks and benefits were recorded, and he could actually walk the jury through how the amounts of those perks were later deducted from his pay to the benefit of the Trump Organization. So he could really spell this stuff out pretty clearly. And in fact, he won't be sentenced until after the trial. So there's a strong incentive for Weisselberg to fully cooperate at this trial and show prosecutors that he is telling the jury everything that they want the jury to hear.
He's pled guilty to serious charges involving a lot of money. And considering the fact that some Americans get sentenced to life in prison for stealing, you know, less than $200 worth, 100 days seems light. Is that because he's agreed to testify against the Trump Organization?
I think that's right. My understanding, and I don't think that we have this in writing yet, is that he's likely to be in Rikers Island prison, which is not a pleasant place to be. He turned 75 this month. And in the end, he did spare prosecutors the difficulty and expense of putting on a trial with him. It's going to really simplify the trial for the Trump Organization. So it's true. It does seem light, certainly compared to so many of the other people that probably went through Manhattan criminal court just today.
That's Ilya Meretz, who covers Trump legal matters for NPR. He's also co-host of the podcast We'll Be Wild about the January 6th Capitol attack. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Taiwan and the United States say they will start trade talks this fall. This after a controversial visit by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. And more members of Congress went there this week. Well, China reacted by staging military drills around Taiwan, which it considers part of China. Let's bring in Shelley Rieger now. She's a political scientist at Davidson College and author of The Tiger Leading the Dragon, How Taiwan Propelled China's Economic Rise. Shelley, nice to talk to you.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
So the Chinese military continues to make aggressive moves around Taiwan after the Pelosi visit and this follow-up visit by other members of the U.S. Congress. Have these visits raised tensions or, from Taiwan's perspective, made things more dicey? This is a small island, 23 million people.
Yeah, absolutely. The problem is that it's not at all clear that these kinds of gestures really do anything to enhance Taiwan's security. And in this instance, given the intensity of Beijing's military reaction, it seems pretty likely that they've actually eroded Taiwan's security to some extent. And I think that as much as people in Taiwan are reluctant to say anything negative to or about American leaders, I think they're feeling that pressure in a new way since the Pelosi visit.
Well, in Beijing, the Chinese military seems to be trying to show it can invade Taiwan, take it by force. Is the military conventional wisdom that yes, it can?
No, not yet. You know, certainly the People's Liberation Army is much more capable than it was even a few years ago, and they have devoted enormous resources to creating the capability to actually invade and occupy and control Taiwan. But I think it is pretty widely understood that this is still a highly risky proposition. So I think what we are seeing now is more about deterring Taiwan from thinking that, you know, the strong support that it may be getting from some in the United States is enough to justify pushing the boundaries in its relationship with China, rather than actually, you know, the PRC winding up for the sort of strikeout pitch.
We spoke recently to Kevin Rudd, the former Prime Minister of Australia, longtime China scholar, as you know, and he thinks Beijing, in his new book, will try to unify with Taiwan during the Xi Jinping era, say in the next 10 or 15 years. Are leaders in Taiwan seeing this question the same way?
Leaders in Taiwan are not thinking about the near-term or even the medium-term future in, like, it's a done deal, we've run out of options way at all. They have been very creative and quite flexible in coming up with ways of evading or avoiding that outcome. And I think that will continue to be the case. So while I understand the logic of, you know, it's got to happen within Xi Jinping's term, and Xi Jinping's term is X number of years, so ipso facto, this is the timeline, I don't actually think the PRC has any desire or intention to lock itself in to a timeline that it might not be able to achieve.
Yeah. Now, from far away here in the U.S., a lot of people may assume Taiwan and China are these enemies, that there's this oceanic Berlin Wall up there. But you have written a lot about economic integration. How much has Taiwan contributed to China's economic power, to China's consumer culture today?
Without Taiwanese investors, we would not see the Chinese economy that we see today. There is an enormous amount, nobody really knows, but it is probably somewhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion of Taiwanese investment in mainland China. And most of that investment, it's not portfolio investment, it's, you know, actual physical facilities, technology, factories, all that stuff. It's a huge relationship, and it's not going away.
Yeah. Finally, I mean, you go to Taiwan regularly, speak to the people there. How are Taiwanese leaders and people looking at a less powerful country in Europe being invaded by a geopolitical power, that is, Ukraine invaded by Russia, and whether it's a preview of what might happen there?
That's a big conversation in Taiwan. Most people don't want to draw the parallel too directly, but I think they recognize that the invasion of Ukraine kind of changed the calculus about what is possible. And I think there was a sense in Taiwan in the last 20 or 30 years that it just doesn't make sense for the PRC to invade Taiwan. Like, what would they have to gain? Look how much they would have to lose. It just can't happen. But I think many Ukrainians had that same calculus about Russia. It just doesn't make sense. You know, a 20th century style invasion with tanks and stuff. Like, who does that anymore? Well, it turns out it can happen. Mm. And it has not gone unnoticed in Taiwan that, you know, the possibility of actual kinetic catastrophe is realer today than it was before February 24th. Yeah.
Shaley Rieger is professor of political science at Davidson College. Shaley, thanks so much for the time.
You are very welcome, Scott.
The Centers for Disease Control is set to make some big changes to its organizational culture. Director Rochelle Walensky acknowledged yesterday that the CDC had fallen short in its response to the COVID-19 pandemic and announced plans to make the organization less academic and more agile. Here she is speaking with CBS News.
We learned some hard lessons over the last 3 years, and as part of that, it's my responsibility, it's the agency's responsibility to learn from those lessons and do better.
For more, let's bring in Dr. Abdul Al-Sayed, an epidemiologist and former head of the Detroit Health Department. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Celeste.
So what do you think of the planned changes to the CDC?
I think it's welcome news. You look at the challenges and the way that they fell. These reorganization plans really do map to those challenges. You are bringing the offices of science under the director's office, so there's faster information flow that's more about agility than it is about academic publications. You have a real investment in communications, recognizing that the 2022 media environment isn't one where authority automatically assumes that you're going to be listened to. And then the third piece here is a focus on the communication with government. There are a lot of the CDC is a government clearinghouse for public health. They engage with the rest of Health and Human Services. They engage with state and local health departments. And so they're building a an intergovernmental affairs office in the CDC to try and be a way station across that. So it really does map to the challenges that we saw during the pandemic.
Speaking of government, though, we have seen decades of political interference in the workings of the CDC from members of Congress and others. How has that impacted not only the agency's ability to carry out its work, but its ability to institute reforms?
You know, that's a really important point, Celeste. So much of the challenge with the CDC had a lot to do with the political interference in the Trump administration. And the question now is, how much can the CDC actually do that engages with a lot of the challenges that happen outside of them? And I think the CDC is trying to acknowledge the way the world has become, recognize what it can do inside itself to be more agile, to be more efficient and effective in the context of new outbreaks. But at the same time, the point that you're making here is that there are so many challenges, whether it's the political environment or it is the moment of our public conversation that is so fraught, the level of misinformation and disinformation that the CDC really can't control. And so when it comes to these challenges, they really do need the backing of the administration. And we'll have to wait to see exactly what the administration feels about these changes, how they signal these changes in and around the rest of the federal government and then beyond.
The CDC struggled with clear and consistent messaging all through the pandemic. It has struggled with that in years past. As someone who had to put out messages to the public, why is it so difficult to issue these kind of clear, understandable messages about public health issues?
Well, I think this moment is really quite unique in terms of the history of public communication. In the past, it was assumed that if you were a physician or a scientist with an MD, an MPH, a PhD, that you were automatically going to be able to cut through the noise in the public conversation. This moment, though, is so saturated in terms of all of the conversation on the internet, the mis and disinformation that flows across social media, that public communicators and public health communicators in particular need to be a lot more thoughtful about how they engage. And you're not just trying to message into a space where people are implicitly listening to you. You also have to command attention. And that means concision, but also speed and comprehensiveness. And getting all three of those correctly at the same time is really challenging. And so this is a new moment, and these agencies are trying to shift around it.
Dr. Abdul Al-Sayed, an epidemiologist and former head of the Detroit Health Department, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now to the baseball diamond, where those who play a certain position have it rather rough. Nobody wants their autographs. We're talking about umpires. Pro umps work alongside, or I guess behind, some of the richest and most powerful athletes in the world. Long hours, under the summer sun, and they take most of their heat from players and managers and fans. It's a tough job for young umpires, too, so why do they do it? Colorado Public Radio's Vic Vela recently took that question to some aspiring umpires.
They're gonna put me in the movies. They're gonna make the big star out of me.
Buck Owens sang about how he could play the role of a sad and lonely guy in a movie because he already plays the part so well.
And all I gotta do is act naturally.
And there's no sadder or lonelier job in baseball than being an umpire. No one's there to see you, and you get all kinds of grief. If there's a baseball game happening somewhere, an umpire is getting booed. It's just a fact of life. And that dynamic, as old as the game itself, has long been etched into popular culture, like in the 1950 movie amazingly titled Kill the Umpire.
Man was safe a mile.
What are you trying to give us? I'm trying to save.
He was safe a mile. They faced you, murderer. Get dresses, you robber. Kill the umpire. Kill the umpire.
And sometimes movies portray umpires as totally inept, like this classic scene from the 1988 comedy The Naked Gun, where an umpire gets into an argument with another umpire.
He was safe. He never tagged him with the ball.
You idiot. He was out when you were out of the base line.
All right, I've had enough. You're out of here.
What do you mean?
You can't throw an umpire out of the game.
Yeah. All right, you're out of here.
So umpires face an uphill battle in getting the respect they deserve. That's something 20-year-old Grant Johnson of Little Rock, Arkansas knows all about. He umpires at the high school level.
Parents yell at you, they'll call you whatever they want because they don't care. At the end of the day, they're not going to see you. They let their mind free and their tongue loose and just say what they want.
Get set! Roll it! Ball three!
Johnson was one of more than 100 attendees of a recent umpire clinic held at Coors Field in Denver, where they received free training from former Major League Baseball umpires. The league holds a handful of events like these every summer to try to get more umpires on the professional baseball path. But like any job, you don't start at the top. To get there, you likely have to start anywhere from little league to high school, where fan behavior can be the worst.
I just think we've become a brasher, louder, less civil society, and it plays out at sporting events.
That's Barry Mano, who heads the National Association of Sports Officials. He says youth and high school sports face an officiating crisis because more and more referees and umpires are quitting because they're tired of dealing with unruly coaches, parents, and fans.
We're getting at the National Association of Sports Officials a report of a physical assault almost daily. That was unheard of before.
And bad behavior makes headlines. A few years ago in Lakewood, Colorado, a fight broke out among parents who were angry over a call made by a 13-year-old umpire in a game where the players were just 7 years old. And earlier this year in Abilene, Texas, an umpire had to go to the hospital after a coach shoved him to the ground during a game. Dale Scott is a retired Major League Baseball umpire.
It just takes away from the joy of these kids trying to play a frickin' game. One of the reasons we're so short on officials because the older guys are retiring or are leaving the field, and we're not getting that recruitment of younger officials to, you know, that'll have years of work ahead of them because they quit. They can't handle it.
And when coaches and fans act that way, it takes a toll on the players. Giuliano Pinelli plays baseball for Legacy High School in Broomfield, Colorado.
I mean, come on. These guys are getting paid not that much to help us out, and we wouldn't be playing without them. But, you know, everybody makes mistakes. It's calls. That's why they're there. I mean, to get better, really.
First base umpire, move up a little. There you go.
Back at the umpire clinic in Denver, Longtime Major League Baseball umpire Ed Rapuano tries to pump a little encouragement into folks who are there for his expertise.
You have to be thick-skinned. I mean, you're going to make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes, you know, in all facets of life. When you're officiating baseball, it's a game. And if you start treating it like a game and having fun, your judgment, your reactions are going to be a lot better than if you think, you know, it's not a life or death situation.
Safe! Safe!
20-year-old Grant Johnson, who we heard from earlier, says he refuses to let a few bad experiences with fans and parents take away from his dream of becoming a big league umpire.
I've been playing since I was 4 years old, just a passion for the sport. People can say whatever they want to me. That's fine with me. It won't change my love for the game.
18-year-old Zai Menicky feels the same way.
Do you want to keep doing this?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
How far do you want to go?
I want to umpire a game here. Being on this field already at Coors Field is, I've smiled. I've, like, secretly taken pictures already. But I guess a goal of mine would be to umpire a game here at Coors Field. Just get to the majors one day. I don't care if it's, like, just for one game.
Well, I'll bet you I'm gonna be a big star. Might win an Oscar, you can't never tell.
And umpires like Menicky hope that fans can cut them a little slack so they could feel a little less sad and lonely while they're trying to do their jobs. For Here and Now, I'm Vic Vella.
Well, I hope you come see me.
And we want to hear your tales of being an umpire or a referee at any level. Tell us your experience and bring it all. We know how to bleep. Email us, or better yet, send a voice memo to hereandnow.org. It's Here and Now.
We'll make the scene about a man that's sad and lonely and baking down upon his bended knee. I'll play the part.
After President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act into law this week, you may be wondering how to take advantage of all the new tax credits in the bill. There are incentives for putting solar panels on your roof or converting to an electric stove. But there are also plenty of new tax credits for purchasing electric vehicles. And yet, there's a lot you should know before you head over to the dealership. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, Philip.
So tax credits are not always simple, rarely
no.
simple. And that's certainly true for these new credits for EVs. What do people need to know before they buy a new electric car?
Well, it's generally simpler than a lot of other ones, but there's still some complexity to it. First of all, the context is that the price of cars, used and new, is way up, right? Because the semiconductor shortage has meant that it just costs more to buy anything. So a credit at this point is very useful, and if it sways people into buying an electric car, that could be very useful. However, there are some new rules. So there's a $7,500 credit that already existed to buy a new electric vehicle, but it was phased out after an automaker sold 200,000 electric vehicles. So a lot of vehicles that this was not available for. Now the law ends the 200,000 unit per manufacturer beginning in 2023. So in some cases, you'll have to wait till the beginning of 2023 to get it. It's a $7,500 credit for a new electric vehicle and a $4,000 credit for a used one. Now there are income and earning caps on this, but that's the basic rules. It's $7,500 on a new electric vehicle from a company that no longer has that cap because they made too many cars, or $4,000 for a used one.
And as you said, you may not qualify if you earn too much money. Also, if you're buying a luxury vehicle, you may not get a tax credit. What does that refer to?
Yeah, so there's both a cap on the price of the vehicle that you can get the credit for and the earnings of the person doing it. So if you're a single filer, if you earn $150,000 or less, you can get either the $7,500 credit or the $4,000 credit. If you're the head of household and the household earnings are $225,000 or less, or if you're a joint filer and it's $300,000 or less. So those are, if you earn above those limits, you're just not qualifying for the credit at all. Now, the buyers can continue to claim the credit on their annual tax filing, but this is an interesting thing. This only starts in 2024. you'll have the ability to transfer the value of the credit to the dealer as soon as you buy it, and the dealer will take it off the cost of the vehicle. So that's actually interesting that you don't have to wait till you file your taxes in order to get the credit. But look, the used vehicle credit, by the way, is a little bit more stringent. Your maximum income for that is $75,000 for single filers, $112,000 for a household, or $150,000 for a joint filer. So if you're buying a used car, you have to actually make less than if you were buying a new car.
We've only got about 30 seconds, Ali, but do you think this might be effective at not just selling more vehicles, but getting more made?
Yeah, I think it's going to because there was a disincentive after you sold 200,000 cars. So I think this will cause electric car makers to make more of them. And just by virtue of the point in time that we're at where used and new cars are so much more expensive than they typically are, the idea that there's either a $4,000 or $7,500 discount, I think will make a difference. It'll move the needle and we're going to see a lot more electric cars on the road.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Author Salman Rushdie remains in critical condition. Last Friday, he was about to speak at the Chautauqua Institution in New York on artistic freedom when an attacker stabbed him repeatedly. His family says he suffered life-changing injuries, and Rushdie may lose an eye. For more than three decades, Salman Rushdie has been under a death threat issued by the Ayatollah in Iran. It came after his book, The Satanic Verses, came out. He spent a decade after that threat in hiding, but ever since, Rushdie has defended freedom of expression in public. Here he is, speaking in New York in 2010.
Comedy is a very good weapon. Tyrants always lock up the comedians first, because to be ridiculed is the worst fate. Satire and ridicule are what tyrants fear more than anything else, you know, to be made to look ridiculous.
Joining us now is a longtime friend of Salman Rushdie. Suzanne Nossel heads up Pen America, a group dedicated to free expression and human rights. Suzanne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You were in communication with Salman Rushdie, I understand, in the hours just before the attack. How did he seem then?
He seemed fine. We were emailing about Ukrainian writers and how to bring them to safety at a safe haven in Pittsburgh with the individual who he was about to go up on stage with at Chautauqua. So he was trying to figure out who might avail themselves of this opportunity and focused, as he was so often, on endangered writers around the world and how to help them.
Yeah, wow. And so have you been in touch with him since? Had a chance to get a sense of how he is or how his family is?
You know, my sense is it's difficult. You know, these were really serious injuries, as you say. His family's reported that they're life-altering. I think he faces a long and challenging road ahead. So I don't think one should minimize what he went through. This was a savage attack that did real harm.
Yeah. Can I ask you to kind of step back and tell us a little bit more about the book that prompted so much anger from the Ayatollah in Iran? You know, in our editorial meetings, there are some young people on our staff who don't know anything about this. I mean, why was the Satanic Verses so offensive, seen as so controversial in some quarters?
Well, I mean, it has to do with the sensitivity in Islam about depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. And in the Satanic Verses, Muhammad is a character. You know, some of the twists and turns may not portray him favorably. You know, but we've seen other incidents that have to do with visual depictions of the Prophet Muhammad triggering violence. So this is a kind of a sacrosanct thing that, you know, in at least a certain branch of Islam is viewed as kind of something you cannot touch, you cannot write about, you cannot depict visually. And if you do, that is grounds for violence. And in Salman's case, a fatwa or ordering his murder. And so you know, that's what's at the root of this. You know, the book is a novel, so it's fictional. And, you know, in our view as PEN America, there's no work of fiction that could possibly be the basis for a violent reprisal.
Yeah. Now, being a man under a death threat for decades because of this decree from the Islamic government in Iran gave Salman Rushdie a kind of international notoriety as someone representing freedom of expression. He talked about this in a variety of venues, and here he is talking to graduating students in 2015 at Emory University in Atlanta.
Not all of human nature can be considered good, which is why most of the Ten Commandments tell us what we should not do. Not kill, not lie, so on. But the best of human nature is our innate understanding of and need for personal liberty. Nobody anywhere ever enjoyed being a slave. Everybody, everywhere, offered a chance of freedom, grasps it as a thirsty man seizes a drink.
Suzanne, why has he remained a public figure? Why is it so important to him? Has there been any ambivalence that he's voiced about kind of being such a public figure in this debate?
You know, I think it's a very unusual life to live. He wrote a memoir in 2012 called Joseph Anton, which was the pseudonym that he used when he was in hiding for all of those years, about the trauma and dislocation of having to be underground, having to move around from house to house, being cut off from so many of his activities and associates for such a long period. And I think it's an enduring trauma, but also one that he had in many ways surmounted. He was living a public life. As long as I've known him, he's been out there at events, at parties, at readings, just a very active and fearless person.
You have described him as a man who never flinched or faltered, a man of great humor. I mean, the person he is, despite this threat.
Yeah, he's very witty and eloquent and sort of a charming presence. He can be, kind of bracing, maybe a little bit acid-tongued from time to time. He speaks his mind, but he's a very compelling speaker, and he's deeply passionate. I mean, I've been looking through some of our email exchanges over the years. You know, there was a time where a South African writer had quoted from his work, and she came under sort of withering fire from within the Muslim community in South Africa and, ended up in a mental institution at the behest of her family and religious figures. And Salman was just so determined to get her freed, and he was mobilizing literary activists from all over the world and made it happen just over a couple of days. And it was just really quite extraordinary. She was not someone he knew. She was not someone famous, but she was suffering and he was absolutely by her side and determined to make it right.
Yeah. You know, the person you describe, and it makes me think of other individuals who have been kind of caught up in this battle over words. One of the translators of his book, Satanic Verses, was murdered. A publisher was attacked. Does this go to the power of words?
It does. I mean, anyone who thinks sort of books are over with and it's all about TikTok, they have it wrong. I mean, books are influential enough that there are 277 writers around the world who are in prison by our last count as a result of their words. And so, words can spark transformation, revolution, changes of ideology, and authoritarians recognize that. And, writers, I think, have to come to grips with the power of their words and the risk of expressing themselves. And I think this has brought that home in a very potent way. Just how much words matter, how writing is an act of courage, what it takes to tell stories others don't want to have heard.
Your group, PEN America, is planning a demonstration on the steps of the New York Public Library. What do you hope will come from the collective response to this brutal attack?
Yeah, well, tomorrow We will be gathering on the steps of the New York Public Library to read from Salman's work as a gesture of solidarity and connection to him and amongst ourselves. And, you know, we're at PEN America celebrating our centenary. We're 100 years old this year. And I think this event, my hope is this event and this horrific incident can be a kind of galvanizing fuel to power us into the next 100 years of waging these fights. Because whether it's book bans in school boards and libraries across the country, or bans on curriculum and what can be taught in higher education, or the rise of authoritarianism around the world, we have our work cut out for us, and we need all of the support and energy and gusto that we can muster. And Salman has been kind of a life force for that for a long time, and I hope that this inspires others to take up the mantle.
Suzanne Nossel is Chief Executive Officer of PEN America. Suzanne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The classic blaxploitation film Superfly celebrates its 50th anniversary this month. NPR's Eric Deggans talked to several people who made the movie to discover how a scrappy independent film about a cocaine dealer became one of the most influential black-centered films in history.
Even if you haven't seen the movie, you probably know the theme song.
Oh, Superfly!
Along with Shaft, which was released a year earlier, R&B star Curtis Mayfield's theme for Superfly led one of the most successful movie soundtracks of the blaxploitation era. It helped turn the film into one of the most profitable movies of its time, earning millions while briefly dethroning The Godfather as the top film of 1972.
Ooh,
and since then, the movie's gritty, authentic depiction of street life and its flamboyant lead character, a sharp-dressing, karate-kicking drug dealer named Youngblood Priest, helped create archetypes which inspired legions of storytellers and musicians. There's films like New Jack City and TV shows like The Wire. In music, influences range from Mary J. Blige sampling Mayfield's Give Me Your Love for her hit, I'm the Only Woman, to Fishbone rocking out on a cover of Mayfield's hit, Freddy's Dead. Still, there's a lot some people don't know about the film Superfly, including the meaning of the title, which describes the high quality of cocaine that Priest sold.
Fly was the term at the time. Well, that's fly. You know, looking fly. I put super to it and made Superfly.
That's Philip Fenty, a former advertising executive who wrote the script for Superfly. Aware of the success of Shaft and inspired by a burgeoning black-centered independent film and theater movement in New York, Fenty wanted to write his own film. He saw a cover story in New York Magazine about a rising black drug dealer called the Man with the Golden Nose. And then a friend brought a dealer to Fenty's apartment in New York, warning him not to square up or act too straight-laced.
He said, boy, don't you square up on me. So, oh, please, come in. It was truly one of the most incredible evenings I've ever spent my entire life.
Fenty worked with Nate Adams, a boyhood friend, who developed the character's signature look by digging up the clothes himself. Adams also found the tricked-out car that Priest drives, a Cadillac Eldorado with custom Rolls-Royce-style grille and special headlights, driven by a guy at a local shoeshine parlor. They team with producer Sig Shore for funds, casting another friend from Cleveland, up-and-coming stage actor Ron O'Neill, as Priest, a smart player seeking one last score to get out of the life. Of course, another reason the film hit big was Mayfield's soundtrack, packed with hits like Freddy's Dead, Pusher Man, and the film's theme song. Todd Mayfield, Curtis's son, said his father began writing songs almost immediately after Fenty and Shore gave him a script, creating songs with stories that added to the film's narrative.
The soundtrack made these characters more than one-dimensional, you know. It gave them some depth, and it made you sometimes think about them in a little bit of a different way than the face value that you're seeing early in the film.
But not everyone loves seeing black drug dealers and the street life humanized. Junius Griffin, then president of the NAACP's Beverly Hills Hollywood branch, is credited with coining the term blaxploitation shortly after the film's release, saying such films exploit black people while encouraging them to embrace destructive ideals. Sheila Frazier, who played Priest's girlfriend Georgia, still sees the word blaxploitation as an insult.
Oh, I can't stand it. I can't stand it. They didn't call it white exploitation when we looked at Cagney films and a lot of the films that dealt with mafia and bootlegging.
Todd Boyd, a professor at the University of Southern California and a cultural commentator featured in the DVD commentary for Superfly, agrees with Frazier. He notes that Priest outsmarts corrupt cops and rivals to get out of a life that's dangerous and depressing.
There's a sense of black power mixed with capitalism and this desire to be kind of a street entrepreneur. And to put it in a film, it kind of gives that pursuit of life meaning in a way that it wouldn't have had otherwise.
Superfly eventually spawned two half-hearted sequels and a 2018 remake film. Many of those involved in making the original movie, including O'Neill and Shore, have died, but the film's influence lives on. Frazier says Superfly succeeded by showing black people something they hadn't seen before.
That was one of the rare times that someone from the inner city won, and like he walked away with not one hair touched on his pretty head.
Fenty offers a simpler explanation.
We in this country love outlaws. We still do. So he came from that, from the bottom. No way to get to the top from the bottom is to be an outlaw.
As the nation still struggles with racism, poverty, police brutality, and social decay, the themes in Superfly remain resonant as ever 50 years on. I'm Eric Deggans.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Scott Tong. This is Here and Now.